Hello, it's News Talk's Jess Kelly here. Before we get to this podcast, I want to talk to the business owners out there who know the value of having the right partner behind them. When it comes to empowering your business, Electric Ireland is the trusted energy brand that Irish companies rely on. As Ireland's leading energy supplier, they offer fixed price plans, expert advice and future-focused solutions, including solar power installation to support your business on its journey to net zero. Electric Ireland, making your business brighter. Visit electricireland.ie/business to learn more. Now, enjoy your podcast.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Well, now it's time for our Friday forum, our first of 2026, and I'm joined by Louise Byrne, political correspondent with the Irish Examiner, Harry Brown, senior lecturer in the School of Media at TU Dublin, and Ona Malley, lecturer in politics at DCU. Good morning, one and all, and welcome. I thought we might cast our minds maybe not too far back to 2025. We'd parsed and analysed that year long enough, I think. But in recent days, and looking at government, Owen, I'll go to you first. And, you know, the Thornish's round of interviews over the Christmas period. What did you make of it?
Oh, so I think it probably indicates that, I mean, the Taoiseach, the Thornish, the leader of Sinn Féin, Mary Lou MacDonald, have all been referencing homelessness and immigration in the last week or so. And so I suspect it's going to be the issue in 2026.
Are they all conflating the two, saying one is linked to the other? Because if you take it, just do the sums. If you've got a lot of people coming in who don't have a home and you're not building enough homes for the people at home, clearly they will add to the crisis. Not cause it, but add to it.
Yeah, so I think there's a general acceptance that Ireland's population increase is exceptionally fast. It's by far the fastest in Europe. And if you are trying to build homes at the same time that you have large numbers of people coming into the country, because the population increases is largely driven by inward migration, the two are linked. And I think everybody is now beginning to accept that, which is odd because about 3 years ago, anybody who said it was told that they were far right and an extremist and a racist and various other things. But now you do see it. And so I suspect when we see both Mary Lou MacDonald and Micheál Martin and Simon Harris all talking about it, it is going to be something that's on. It's an issue, going to be an issue this year.
So who are going to be the dissenting voices then, Louise? Will it be the Labour Party who'll say this is stuff and nonsense, you know?
Yeah, and I think you saw the Labour Party and the Social Democrats both issue quite strong statements the other day following those comments from Thornish Simon Harris in an interview with Ellen Coyne in the Irish Times. But you also saw Sinn Féin pushing back, and you saw a statement from Eoin O'Brien accusing the Thornish of making dangerous comments. And I think, you know, everyone is talking about homelessness and immigration, but I think it's the manner in which they're talking about these things are completely different. So I sat down with Mary Lou MacDonald. I was one of, I think, about a dozen people reading the papers the last few days who sat down with Mary Lou before the Christmas. And you might remember at the time the Taoiseach had said in the Dáil that there is migratory pressure is having an impact on homelessness. And she was saying, you know, that is the government shifting blame to someone else for their issues because they are, you know, not dealing with the homelessness crisis adequately. But then in the next breath, she said, but yeah, it is having an impact. That's not new news. You know, it is having an impact. So I guess it's how you look at it. And I think Eoin O'Brien's point the other day is that, you know, Simon Harris was saying, well, there's a lot of people in homeless accommodation that don't have a right to housing. And Eoin O'Brien was kind of saying, well, that's not really true because people in the IPAS system don't have the right to go into emergency accommodation. So I guess it's not pedantic, it's not quite the right word, but people are essentially saying the same thing, but just different versions of it.
Harry, will you parse all of this for us?
Yeah, well, I think that there is, you know, there's the semantics of it. You know, are we talking about the IPAS system? Are we talking about emergency accommodation? Or are we talking about all immigration and the pressure that brings on the housing market? And when we conflate those three sets of things, I think we're making a mistake. And that makes it too easy to say that the problem is, you know, asylum seekers.
But there are segments of people. Yeah. For example, if you're coming in to work in the tech down in Silicon Docks, so-called, you probably can afford the kind of rents that the big investment funds are charging for their accommodation.
And that I would say that's more of where the pressure on the housing market is coming rather than from a few hundred asylum seekers.
They are catered for. Do you know what I mean? Those people,
well, they're catered for, but that's housing. That's housing that's being occupied, and that's housing that's driving up the cost of rental.
I was driving through the Cherrywood complex the other day, and I remember when I started here on News Talk all of 12 years ago, we did an item on Cherrywood and the great plans that Hines had. And I'm surprised that it's not all built out yet, and yeah. it's not. But driving through the complex, I notice so many of the apartments are unoccupied. And I'm wondering, is that because they're not affordable for ordinary people?
It's because they're all built to rent. And as someone who's from out that neck of the woods and who might meet myself and my friends are looking to buy houses, looking to buy apartments, they are all build to rent. So you can exactly. see all these apartments flying up, but the rents are astronomical and no
and
one can
empty.
Afford them.
And this
but no
is
one
the
can
point.
Afford them. And, you know, we talk so much about when we saw it during the budget when the government was introducing the VAT breaks for the apartment builders and saying, oh, well, this is the only way that we make apartments viable. But you have to look at the kind of tenure that you're building and the kind of tenancy that you're creating. Are you building apartments that no one can afford to rent because they're all built to rent and no one can buy
so
them?
So this is
the
question, Owen. Are those numbers then flattering to deceive? In other words, we built all these apartments. The fact that they're not occupied.
Yeah, well, I mean, I live near where there are 400 built-to-rent apartments and I walk my dog through them every morning. And you do notice that there are apartments that are just lying there empty for 6 months at a time. Different people will blame it on different things. One could argue that it's possibly because we have rent controls. Those companies can't reduce the rent because they wouldn't be able to bring them back up again. So we have those difficulties where landlords aren't
you
able
see,
the, to...
Doesn't the market be a flexibility, to, for example? I mean, no landlord would want to have their premises empty for a protracted period. It's money lost. It's like a hotel bedroom or an airline seat. Once it's gone, it's gone. So that month of rent is, you can't get it back. So is there a need for more flexibility that they're allowed to set their headline rent when they open up, but give people discounts?
I think there should be. But I mean, it could also be that these are companies that are investing in a commodity of housing and they're not that interested in whether it's full or not because yeah. they know the value of it is going up and up and up.
Exactly. They're hoarding an asset there. So it's not, you know, when housing is treated like an asset that can be hoarded by these kinds of companies, then you're going to have situations where people are, you know, restricting the supply. I think the real danger, and this is why I think it's important that the left has been speaking out in the way that it has, the real danger is to conflate the basic obligation we have to people who are fleeing war and poverty. And to make
we don't
them,
have any obligation to people fleeing poverty.
Well, we have. Sorry, that's fair enough. But, you know, we do help to create the poverty that people are fleeing. Of course, well, we do. We are a very
general way.
We are a very rich country that benefits from the exploitation of.
But
the
Harry,
developing
no.
world.
In fairness, Ireland and in terms of our international aid has not been diminished. In yep. spite of Trump doing what he's done all over the place, I mean,
look, international aid is a drop in the bucket compared to the suffering of people in the world. And we know, for example, that you know the number of people that came here from Ukraine was, of course, a source of pressure in housing. But we also know that we consider that an important obligation for people who were facing the terrible depredations of war, and that's going on all over the world. I mean, you know, you had what happened in Afghanistan over the last while, and we have a program for Afghan refugees as well, and those are the right thing to do. But turning our eyes away from what the landlords are doing, turning our mind away from the government's failure to build social and affordable housing, I think, and allowing ourselves to be dragged into a conversation about asylum seekers or
but do,
other
do you believe there should be any limit on the numbers of people proportionate to our own population that come in? Because I know in time the Normans came and all the rest of them, and they became, as they say, more Irish than the Irish themselves. But in the short term, I mean, what proportion of our own population should we multiply ourselves by that will maintain social cohesion, which is important?
Are we asking Amazon and Google what proportion of their workforce they're bringing in from abroad? I think those are the questions that we should be asking rather than about the question of how many asylum seekers we can accommodate or how
Except
many refugees from war.
Those people who are coming in from Amazon and Google, they pay for themselves. You know, they're able to...
they take up space. You know that they do.
They work for a living, though. They pay tax.
Yeah, sure. They pay tax and they take, you know, and they're renting, you know, these rental-only apartments that you can't afford in Kilmainham and Cherrywood.
I think the overriding fact of the matter, and I think it's important that we don't move away from this, is that the government is not building enough houses and there are not enough homes being built. And I mean, when you look at the new housing plan that was released by Minister Brown in November, they removed the necessity for year-on-year targets. So we are now flying blind, essentially, for the next 5-6 years on whether or not we are going to have enough homes to build. And, you know, that is, the government can blame whoever they want. They can blame asylum seekers who, you know, who, by the way, who are, when they are seeking asylum, the aim for them, hopefully, is eventually that they will one day pay tax and give back. They're not coming here. Most of them are not coming here for a free ride. But, you know, the overwhelming fact is that there aren't enough houses and the government is certainly not going to build them.
Does it make sense to not have those annual targets? Because you can't build a house planning, build, finish in a year. You can't. So even if they really did wonderful things in January, February and March to get loads of starts going, those houses wouldn't be finished until probably early 2028.
Yeah, so they might think of different types of targets, and so it could be targets of starts, which might be important. I suppose a lot of the problem is we can't say that the government is going to build all these apartments, because governments tend not to do that, but it should be enabling their local councils to do so. And I mean, one of the big problems does seem to be that local councils want to limit the number of new builds in each of their areas. And we can see that there are large spaces around where the councils are reluctant to lift the targets for the number of people who should be living in each council area. And the government probably does need to force those councils to change how they are targeting the number of people that will eventually be living, because we've built our housing plans on the basis of census figures that are so far out of date that they're relatively almost meaningless.
Well, anyone who's driven through Dublin City at any kind of a busy time in the last while realises that Dublin City is choked. And I mean, it's not just in the city centre. Moving around even the outskirts of Dublin is very difficult. So the problem is, you know, we should have done something earlier about this.
We've got a poorly planned country on our hands, Pat. Yeah,
that is the issue. That is the issue. That, you know, we need more connectivity. We put in bus connects. And is that working? I don't know.
No, well, bus connects, you're competing with cars. And so if you're, you know, it isn't working because it doesn't give space. And we should be thinking about how do we get from Dublin to Limerick in under an hour to a high-speed rail line for things like that, for connecting the whole country.
Imagine if you had high-speed rail, and even to the Midlands or down to the sunny southeast or wherever it is, had the idea that, like, someone commuting into London City from Brighton, for example, on a fast train. Mm-hmm. People do it every single day of their working lives.
Yeah, we've...
Hello, it's News Talk's Jess Kelly here. Before we get to this podcast, I want to talk to the business owners out there who know the value of having the right partner behind them. When it comes to empowering your business, Electric Ireland is the trusted energy brand that Irish companies rely on. As Ireland's leading energy supplier, they offer fixed price plans, expert advice and future-focused solutions, including solar power installation to support your business on its journey to net zero. Electric Ireland, making your business brighter. Visit electricireland.ie/business to learn more. Now, enjoy your podcast.
This is the new Weight Watchers. It works for members like Jojo, who's learning simple, healthy habits. Sharia, who's making progress with meds. And Kim, who still gets to eat what she loves. For over 60 years, we've helped millions of members find what works for them. Now, it's your turn. Watch your life open up. Watch your story shift. Watch what you're capable of. Watch it work. Get started today at weightwatchers.com.
Relatively thinly populated country, but we don't have it connected up very well.
And who wouldn't want to live in the sunny southeast if they had half the chance? Now, next year, Louise, in politics, we're going to have by-elections. The parties, I mean, the Green Party are probably hoping that they will regain some of their seats. They only have the one, and the Green Party leader... talking about his ambitions to reframe the green argument. It's going to be difficult for them, I suspect.
Yeah, it's going to be very difficult for them. And when you think back to this time last year, you know, Roderick O'Gorman was coming out of a very, very difficult election. You know, the Green Party were going from being in government for 4.5 years to him being the only TD in the Dáil, and then he is Malcolm Noonan in the Shannon, of course, as well. But he gave quite an interesting interview to the Press Association, which is appearing in a number of the papers across today and yesterday. And he was saying that, you know, the Green Party has been badly damaged before. It could be a lot worse. And he's intent on rebuilding that party. We do have the two by-elections, as you said. We have the one in Galway to replace President Catherine Connolly, and then we also have an election in Dublin Central to replace Pascal Donoghue, who of course decided to take a job with the World Bank in November. So the pressure is going to be on all the parties. And I think, you know, governments don't do well in by-elections and they're kind of looking at their candidates now. But I think speaking to TDs and Fine Gael and in Fianna Fáil, they have fully accepted that they are not going to win either by-election. Mm. So it is, you know, a lot of attention is going to be on the smaller parties, especially I think Sinn Féin in Dublin Central. That is, of course, Mary Lou MacDonald's constituency. But there are strong people, and the Greens have, especially I think in Dublin City, two very strong candidates to pick between Janet Horner and Feljan Jose. So they do have people there, but it's just a question of how do they do it.
And that green agenda, you know, resurrecting the green agenda. We see in Britain that Zach Polanski, the newish green leader there, who I think is a bit of a late convert to all of this. But anyway, he is there and he's very green in his policies now. Whether or not he understands anything about economics,
it doesn't seem that he does.
But anyway, I'm not sure that Roderick O'Gorman will have the same fair wind behind him as Zach Polanski seems to have in Britain.
No, I think the chances of the Greens winning either of those by-elections are kind of slim to nil. Mm. I mean, in fact, probably Sinn Féin should win both if... Yeah. Things are play out the way they should. I think the advantage that the Green Party has is that their members are true believers, and so they will keep fighting because for them this is an existential threat. And so,
time was the big parties would steal the green clothes, and that's how it works. Yeah. Or any policy that a smaller opposition party has, it's stolen by the main guys, and then the smaller party loses their raison d'être. But, I mean, the big parties in an era of Trump are not really going to steal green policies now.
The UK Greens, in effect, have stolen Labour's clothes as they cast them away. So what you have with Zach Polanski is more like a vacuum on the left rather than a particular rise in what you might call the traditional green agenda, I think it's fair to say. And I think that's, you know, as Owen says, Sinn Féin should be in pole position here. The performance of the smaller left parties will be interesting. And there is a tradition in both constituencies of independent left TDs, including, of course, Catherine Connolly herself in Galway. So I think that it's one to watch. But yeah, Sinn Féin should be in pole position. And the most recent electoral test that we have, obviously, is the presidential election. And I think Catherine Connolly was in the kind of 70%+ in both those constituencies. So certainly if there are any coattails for the left in general, for Sinn Féin, which clearly sees itself as having kind of partly engineered that victory.
We might have Jerry Hutch in Dublin Central, which could absolutely at least make it interesting. Yeah. I could see him topping the poll, but not winning.
It's a lot harder in a by-election, isn't it? Because you only have the one seat. And, you know, and that's the thing you saw about Jerry Hutch in the election in 2024, where it was, you know, people were being elected, people were being knocked out, you had more transfers. Mm. It's much, much harder to get 51% of the vote to win a seat in a by-election. So I think Owen's right. I think it will be interesting, but... God only knows.
Now, he has his difficulties in Spain. So whether or not they will inhibit any campaign he might run, whether or not...
He was able to travel to Ireland for the general election. So I assume the same will be true here.
The question is, if he sets foot in Spain again, is he in trouble there? Anyway, that's for another day. Luis, you drew my attention to the Taoiseach talking about the sectarian abuse of Heather Humphreys during the Oras campaign being a worry.
Yeah, and this was from an interview that I did with the Taoiseach before Christmas time, and we were talking about the presidential election and essentially Heather Humphreys' failed campaign, if we're being honest. And I was asking him about, you might remember, Pat, the Catherine Connolly attack video that Fine Gael put out on the Sunday before the voting, and that was essentially questioning or calling into question her work as a barrister for the banks during home repossession cases. And essentially what I said to the Taoiseach was, do you regret putting that out? And he was like, listen, it wasn't overly personal. He didn't seem to have any regrets. But what he did say on the back of that was, you know, that video was talked about an awful lot, but what was talked about a lot less was the sectarian abuse that was aimed at Heather Humphreys during the campaign. And he said that he didn't quite realise the extent of that during the campaign itself, but it's only in hindsight now that he's realised it. And he said that it should act as a wake-up call for not only politicians, but for the Irish public on the amount of work that has to be done if we want to have a united Ireland, because his exact words were, you know, the orange isn't just on the flag because we wanted another colour. If we are to reunite this country, we are also reuniting with people like Heather Humphreys, who are from a Protestant tradition and from, you know, you might remember the first kind of couple of days of the campaign, there was a lot of questions being asked about Heather's husband's role or, you know, decades ago in the Orange Order, and a lot of being made of that. And he was saying essentially that, you know, it's, you can talk about a united Ireland all you want, but there's a hell of a lot of work that needs to be done to do it. So really, we need to be thinking about that abuse that was levelled at Heather because she is a Presbyterian during the campaign and what that means for the future, you know, united Ireland question.
Oh. Yeah, in my, I thought it was a problem, but I thought a bigger problem for that campaign was that she didn't deal with it very well. Mm. I would have thought when, who was it, John Lee asked about this, she should have just grabbed the flag and said, look at those three colours there. Mm. Do you know what that one stand means, what it symbolises? And she should have owned being, I mean, I predicted that she would win the election on the basis that she was going to be the president who could unite Ireland, who could travel up north and talk to them as one of their own and say to them that there's no threat of a united Ireland.
By the way, there was a very interesting programme made by Andrew Trimble, you know, the former rugby player. And he was talking to someone, a historian in Northern Ireland, who suggested that a better flag for us would be green, blue and orange. The blue representing the Presbyterian tradition.
There you go. Well, I mean, the thing,
what does the white represent?
Peace between the two.
Well, I think it's funny, the sour grapes a bit from the Taoiseach, that he's defending the politicization of the actions of the law library, the normal workings of the law library, but attacking the politicization of the Orange Order, as though the Orange Order were merely like some cultural effusion of Protestant identity, which is a classic thing that that the likes of Fine Gael do.
We never
all the
did
time.
Get
but
Fine, the answer.
The Orange Order is obviously a historically political.
We never did get the answer from Catherine Connolly, though, about did she actually represent banks and having people thrown out of their homes?
Yeah, she
said it was just, I do whatever I do. But barristers have a choice.
Sure.
What cases they take, and that, to say otherwise is not.
I think that she didn't handle that terribly well, but I think the electorate decided that it was fine. And the other thing is that she also, I think it even showed on the ads that Fine Gael used. She may have learned something from her representation of the banks because she spoke very, very well on behalf of people who had been evicted, who had been victimized.
Yeah, I remember. And I remember someone saying that.
Very generous to her.
But I remember someone saying that at the time.
She could have been that generous to herself.
I remember Liz Carlin from the briefing saying that at the time, being like, Fine Gael has essentially handed Catherine Connolly an open goal, because I think the first 60 seconds or possibly even more, it was Catherine Connolly talking about all these government failures of homelessness and housing.
Exactly.
And repossessions. And I mean, Pat's right, she didn't answer the question, but in the end, did the electorate
But she
care?
Spoke
Probably
very
not.
Well in relation to housing issues and the fact that she may have known them from the inside legal cases.
From
only
having
enhanced.
People thrown out of their homes, yeah.
Well, she was very good at avoiding questions and saying exactly what she wanted to. I mean, I think her legal training showed there in her ability to avoid any questions.
But the point about the Orange Order, I think it needs to be said that there's people being annoyed that someone has a connection to a historically sectarian organization in Ireland that is devoted to the maintenance of the union is not a illegitimate form of political commentary. You know, it's not simply a question of cultural identity.
It's been insinuated that the Orange Order is kind of almost a terrorist organization that nobody should be ever admit to having been part of.
No, it's a legitimate political organization. Of course it is. But it is also one that people have
a
right to have.
It's a cultural organization as well.
I want to move on, though, because while we're talking about all of these domestic issues, it's like fiddling when Rome burns. Because with Trump doing what he's doing internationally, with Netanyahu, with Putin, with what's going on in Venezuela, I mean, the world is going to be a tough place in 2026. So.
It is. We'll expect probably more war, even though we have a US president who'll possibly win the Nobel Peace Prize.
FIFA Peace Prize already, come on.
It's all lining up for him. You would hope, given the amount of war in the last number of years, that we should be on a path out of that. But you can see, again, in Venezuela, Trump is being more belligerent than we would have expected him to be, given that he doesn't like starting wars.
But the question of America behaving illegally on the world stage is, I know there have been covert operations by the CIA and so on forever and forever, but to be so blatant about doing things which are patently illegal is disturbing.
And I think it's probably a bigger problem domestically in the US, where he's doing stuff that's illegal within the country.
Exactly,
the rule of law in the US, I'd always kind of assumed that, you know, people are overdoing the fears about the Trump's presidency because, you know, the first time essentially he played ball and he played by the rules. Whereas this year he has shown his willingness not to play by the rules and to break the rules.
Well, I've christened the USA the United States of Avarice. And Scaramucci has said that Trump's ambition is to make $20 billion out of his presidency.
Right, that sounds about right.
And he's already several billion in. Mm-hmm. So this is where we are.
I think it's fair to say that the U.S. has been pretty hard on international law for many, many years. The invasion of Iraq was obviously illegal. You know, it was done in the world court from mining the harbors of Nicaragua back in the 80s. You know, it's not like, as Owen says, the issue now is that Trump is a kind of equal opportunity lawbreaker domestically and internationally. But I think that the situation that Europe finds itself in is the really interesting part of this, because Trump may be warmongering and breaking laws left, right, and center in the Western Hemisphere, but he's actually, you know, pushing for a peace deal in Ukraine that the EU is kind of largely resistant to. And with Ireland taking the EU presidency this year, I think it's going to be in a very interesting position.
Louise?
Yeah, and I mean, I think particularly at that peace deal that's being looked at for Ukraine, you know, it's peace by what cost? Like, how much is he asking Zelensky to give up? And I think everyone wants to see peace in the Middle East. Everyone wants to see peace in Ukraine. But it's, you know, how much sacrifice are people going to make? And what I thought was interesting, I was on Instagram the other day, just doom scrolling on one of my days off, and the White House were putting up kind of highlights of the year, and one of the highlights that they put up was President Trump meeting with Benjamin Netanyahu. So you're like, what side of the war are you on? You're saying you want peace, but yeah, this is, you know, who you're bringing into the White House. So I think it's, please God, we see some semblance of peace in both areas very, very shortly, because the amount of death and destruction is just unconscionable, but it's peace by what cost?
Harry, domestically, though, he's in some trouble.
His poll numbers aren't great. Now, they haven't crashed. The Epstein stuff, obviously, is very damaging for him. You know, today, we're looking at the inauguration yesterday of Zoran Mandani in New York, which is a kind of an interesting new sort of focus for opposition to Trump, a kind of an urban populist movement from the left.
But I keep saying that he's no more lefty than Canada.
Indeed, yes. But he comes out of a kind of movement politics, a bit like Catherine Connolly does, you know. And I don't think you get Mamdani without also of having a big street movement around the Gaza war.
Also, look at the amount of, you know, if you look at the kind of figures who were at Mamdani's inauguration, you know, you had Bernie Sanders doing the pledge, you had Alexandria
Ocasio-Cortez.
Yeah, exactly. Doing, you know, a big speech. Like, is that the politics of the future of America? Is that the people that, you know, people are going to be looking towards
after the lesson for the Democrats is select your candidate in a bespoke way. Look at your constituency and select your candidate accordingly.
Yeah, so he obviously, clearly because he won, suited New York.
Yeah.
He wouldn't suit other parts of the United States, and I suspect would crash if I'm not sure he's eligible to run for the presidency. But even if he were, he would be a candidate who would surely fail.
We said that about Barack Obama, I remember.
Anyway, and was he born in Kenya? Okay, we will leave it there. Louise Byrne, political correspondent with The Examiner. Harry Brown, senior lecturer at the School of Media at TU Dublin, and Owen O'Malley, lecturer in politics at TCU. Thank you one and all. And that's all we have time for on this first programme of 2026. Don't forget, our items from today are uploaded as podcasts, which you can listen to on the Go Loud app. Just search for The Pat Kenny Show. My thanks to our team, producer Niamh Dunn, researchers Leah Doherty, Mia Sherwood-Scully and Dylan Hand, the broadcast assistant Anne-Marie Kane, Cormac McDonagh on sound.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.